Loki sucks dick. Loki sucks dick.
Hello, 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 and welcome to Loki Sucks Dick, a new show where we take a look at the TV series Loki from both a queer perspective and a filmmaking perspective. With me is my co-host, Seth Decker.
Hello!
Welcome, Seth.
I'm so glad to be here. This is a new experiment for Montressor Media. We're mostly into podcasts. This is also available in podcast form in case you prefer that. But we want to get into video. We want you guys to see us, what we look like and what we're like as people. And so Aaron and I are going to flagship this thing and see if it works.
I will flag this ship hard, baby.
This is a brief announcement that will only be in this episode, but just something that I thought was worth bringing up. These are not film theory videos. If you clicked on this for like theories of where the series is going based on the comics or little tidbits you missed in the episode or character histories or anything like specific like a lot of other YouTube channels are doing, we're intentionally not doing that. Nothing wrong with that. I'm sure we'll do it a little bit in every episode.
Yep.
Conjecture's normal. Like, yes. I think that's a normal thing, but
yeah.
we're very specifically not doing that. I love filmmaking. It is my passion, and I thought this was a great opportunity to talk about the kinds of things that come up on our podcasts all the time that we usually just gloss over.
Yeah.
Jumping in and explaining is super helpful. So, and then the other half of it, obviously, is Disney can't be quite as queer as we would like, and so we'll take that job.
Yes, yes. I will be as queer as I like, which is very queer.
Exactly. So those are the two lenses in which we're looking at this series. I really hope you enjoy it. I hope you learn something. Please click subscribe, like the video. Anything that you hear across the video, drop us a comment if you would like to comment on anything we're talking about. You can also take the conversation over to our Discord, which is a public open community Discord. Public open community Discord, I think is what it is. Montressor Media. You can join us there and talk to us all day, every day,
Yay.
And into the night because we never sleep.
Yeah, some of us definitely do never sleep. Never sleep.
And with that being said, unless there's any other asterisks, I think it's time to jump into the episode.
Yes. So, Seth, why don't you start off by telling everybody what you think about the character Loki, like what he means to you, what your previous backstory with that character before coming into this episode, to sort of set some groundwork.
Yeah, so my relationship to Loki is kind of odd. I'm not super familiar with the Thor comics very much at all, so my introduction to Loki was through Thor and then the Avengers within the MCU, so he's kind of like this version is my grounded version of Loki so far.
I mean, if you were going to only have one, like, image of Loki, I would probably choose the MCU version over the comic book version. Loki has some good and bad moments in the comic books. I mean,
yeah.
Most characters do.
Yeah, comics are weird. You know, everybody gets their bad day in comic books, for sure.
That's true. For me, I think Loki, I didn't really read the Thor books, but I did read a lot of Sif's books,
okay.
weirdly enough, just because I really liked her in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., of all things, not where you would expect to like that character from.
Huh.
But I really got into her books, and then I started exploring Loki because, you know, when I started getting into comics, I was looking at characters like, you know, Kate Bishop's Hawkeye. I was looking at Squirrel Girl, like the traditional femme characters. And I'm like, I mean, that's good. I mean, it's better than the characters that I normally associate with in comic books, but it's not really what I'm looking for. So Loki, like, fit, and I didn't really understand why he fit for the longest time. Until 2020 came and I had a gender exploration and I'm like, oh, wow, I am gender fluid, aren't I?
Everything starts to make sense and come full circle.
I know, right?
So a question I think we should explore is, what are our hopes for the show? So I'm very interested.
Ooh.
Now that we've seen the first episode and we get the flavor profile. Wow. we get the flavor profile, if you will. What are some of your hopes for the show going forward? What are you expecting to see? What are you hoping to see? Those kinds of things.
So I think first off, Loki historically in the MCU has been very underpowered. In the comic books, he eventually, for a time, is Sorcerer Supreme. Like, he and Doctor Strange and Wanda are, like, not, like, completely on par, but he's a very capable magic user in his own right. And we've seen a very underpowered, he's really only powerful because, you know, he's been helped out by outside forces. And I'm like, I love that this show already is, this is going to be Loki coming into his own on his own.
Yeah.
Free of that kind of other, you know, like familial expectations, previous associated roles, things like that. So I like that. From like a queer perspective, I'm glad that they've decided they're going to make him gender fluid, that they've put it in the text of the show. I would like for them to be more explicit, like verbally, with like kind of what that means, because like in the comic books, there's some really great scenes where Odin's like, Loki, my son, who is also my daughter. Like, there's really good moments where both parts or multiple parts of that character's nature are evaluated. And as a gender fluid person, I would really like to see that. Also, being able to just see the different Loki variants. I want to see variant L1130 as femme. I don't want them to just be like, oh, variant L1127 happens to be femme, 1130 is dude. Because that just, I don't know, it just feels a little bit disingenuous to call him fluid at that point. It's just like, I don't know, there's a dice rolled when you're born.
Yeah, I guess I would be a little shocked if they put that detail in this episode of Loki being fluid and then flushed it entirely. I do have fears that they're just going to drop, you know, femme Loki into the series as its own character. I don't know. I guess I worry how far they're willing to go, because I don't know where any of this lands with like China and streaming and things like that. Like, how much are they allowed to do and still get paid?
Oh, that's a good point. Are the streaming TV shows even available in China?
I do not know.
Because if they're not, then that would explain why they are tackling all of the more complicated topics in that show. or in the TV shows, rather.
Definitely could be.
So obviously, at the beginning of this, we are set back to a version of Loki that is from the Avengers in terms of moral and personality development. And Loki immediately says, one of his first lines is, I am burdened with glorious purpose. And I feel like as a queer person, that kind of means something different to me. And I'm curious what that means to you, either for yourself, for the character, both.
Yeah. Watching the episode a second and third time, I noticed there's a thematic parallel that happens. And part of what we want to do with the show is kind of explain what we mean when we bring up these like cinematic terms. So not everyone's lost in the weeds. So if you know what that is, cool. If you don't, so the thematic parallel for glorious purpose being the beginning opening line of this character, it gets brought up again towards the end after he's had his shift and learned that the TVA is way more powerful than he assumed, and that assumptions about himself have been kind of thrown back at him by Mobius. And he says it again, but he says it with that like opposite inflection, like he just got the joke, essentially, that he's now in this place where he's not very powerful, which is a new place for him. So that inversion, I wonder if that inversion can be applicable to, you know, people in queer spaces that went through the reverse, where they started out with no power and have now grown into their glorious purpose. I think that's what really grabbed me was, and it's a time travel story, so the story being told backwards thematically could make sense going forwards. Who knows?
I like them.
What about you?
I think for me, especially, you know, doing this show as a creator, you kind of have to go on the internet. If you have any type of like invisibility or like invisible, not typicality, I guess would be how I call it. Like if you're queer, but you're not like obviously queer, if you're disabled, but you're not visibly disabled, you have to make a decision. Am I going to tell everybody on the internet whether or not I am gender fluid, whether or not I'm bisexual, whether or not I'm disabled, Or am I just going to try and pass and hope nobody notices because I know it's going to be better for my career?
Yeah.
But, and it's not just better for your career, though. It's when you're a queer creator who is open in queer spaces, there is so much burden. There is, you are one of us, you represent us, what you do and what you say is important. And for a long time, I wasn't really sure I was ready to step up in that role. Coming into the show, I'm not even 100% certain that I'm ready to be burdened with my chosen glorious purpose. So right. I hope that I'm ready. We'll see.
Yeah, yeah. On literally the exact opposite spectrum is where I sit, where like I have, no disability to claim, and my queerness is completely invisible unless I'm to voice it. And even if I voice it, sometimes people don't believe me because, well, I'm dating a woman. So I get all of the like benefits. Plus, like, I'm a white dude. So like I am burdened with not even burdened, whatever the reverse of burdened is. I'm was built up in a way just, you know, through life that I have to actively recognize those things and then use that to promote other people that don't get those advantages. So it's not a struggle, in case if that's what I'm making it sound like. It's not.
Yeah.
The struggle's all internal of like, all right, but just check yourself real quick because you're not always right. And you know that, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I know that. Okay. And that's like my internal monologue that happens.
And I think when you're privileged, you aren't so much burden. You're less encumbered by glorious purpose. Like, you really get to have your fair choice of purpose. There's, in my life, like, there's been like, I really wanted to be a major league baseball pitcher. Couldn't do that. Not a dude. I really wanted to be a naval submariner. Couldn't do that. Not a dude. Like, there was just thing after thing after thing in my life that was like, oh wait, I can't have that because I didn't be born with a dick. Sorry.
Right. Yeah, all of that just like really sucks for whatever you're gonna run towards. And I guess maybe that was my purpose in bringing up me being the opposite end of that, because, you know, like part of what I get to do is mentorship for people that maybe haven't arrived at the place that they look at the world in that way. And a big part of, I think, Loki's story, and we're going to get into this in the filmmaking part of it too, is the younger brother syndrome, and how he's being, whether he knows it or not, mentored by Thor and vice versa.
Yeah. Against his will, I would
yes,
say.
Yes, very much so.
I love that. I don't have that experience because I don't have any siblings, but the parallel that I draw as an only child is Thor and Loki is like the comic / mythology version of creators like Logan Paul and Jake Paul, or KSI and Deji, where you've got these creators where Big Brother and Little Brother have very similar interests and content creation / like hobbies. You know, they're both into making videos and like and boxing and all of these other things. And you can tell, actually all four of them are, you can tell that the two younger brothers are very in their head about their big brother's success, to the point where KSI and Deji fight very publicly on the internet all the time. And Logan and Jake do from time to time too. Like, Jake was, or Logan's been prepping for this fight, and, his brother steals. I mean, that's a Loki move right now. Your big brother is about to fight Floyd Mayweather for a hell of a bag. And you're like,
oh yeah,
I'm going to steal that motherfucker's hat. That is big Loki energy right there.
Right. Totally. Me and my younger brother are 16 months apart, so we're very, ooh, very close.
Oh,
and
Irish twins.
Yeah, yeah. That's what we were always told growing up. But it's funny because even being that close in age, we are very different personalities, and I kind of came into my own socially a while before he did. He's much more introverted. I'm much more ended up being much more extroverted. But a big issue that we ran into was I didn't know we had a rivalry until until it got ugly. Yeah, I always assumed he and I were like a team, you know, like the two of us, because we were so close in age. We had the same friend group, and like, you know, you rib each other from time to time, but he always gave it back as much as I gave it to him. So I didn't know there was a rivalry until we were like basically adults. Yeah. Shocker.
I think it's hard. I think it's hard, especially when you are younger, to like have that emotional ability to put yourself outside of yourself and be like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I think about like how I view our relationship. What does it actually seem like from his other side? Like, you know, were our parents constantly comparing him to me?
Mm.
That's probably something that happened in Thor and Loki's family. I'm just thinking.
Yeah.
There's probably
yeah.
a comparison there. And it's even harder when you've got a kid that either, I don't think they've really gone into it in the MCU, whether they're going to commit to him being full frost giant. Like, I believe in the comic books right now, he's full frost giant. Laufey, and I don't remember the name of his mother. Comment down below if you remember the name of his mother. Thank you. but yeah, I don't know if they're going to commit to that. I personally think an interesting direction it would go to would be to have Hela be his mother. I know that's not like super in line with lore, but it'd be interesting. It would really change the dynamic with his brother, too. And I'm looking forward to, you know, we're part of the reason that we're setting these questions early is because a lot of the things that we're looking at as concepts in episode one are things that we're going to be looking back at every episode to see, is Loki progressing? Is he regressing? Is it something that the writers have let go entirely?
Right.
And this is one that I'm really interested in. I want to see, because I don't think Chris Hemsworth is going to show up at all. I don't. Foresee that.
I would doubt it as like main sacred timeline Thor. I could see him showing up to do or alternate versions, like different actors as Thor. I could see those things happen. Yeah, I also don't see Chris Hemsworth showing back up in anything other than archive footage like we saw in this episode.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, one of the things that I would have liked to have them do is just have Anthony Hopkins ADR the whole calling him daughter and son. But you know, Anthony Hopkins probably pretty busy dude. It would be nice to see in some way by the end of the series him to be reunited with his family and to get some sort of closure on that, but I don't know that we're going to, and that kind of intrigues me. I definitely don't think we're going to by the end of episode 6.
In this next segment, I would like to dive into some of the filmmaking and writing aspects that are happening within the Loki series. There's two things I want to bring up, and both of them are very exciting to me because I didn't know it was something I wanted until it happened. Well, let me get into that one second. First, because we're just talking about, you know, the younger brother syndrome and how that applies to Loki and Thor.
Yeah.
And the thing that I'd like to talk about, initially I wanted to do the story circle, but I think that might be helpful in a later episode.
Yeah.
Especially since in episode one, we've really only gone through maybe two of the steps in the story circle. So check us out in a couple weeks for that episode. But today I thought we should talk about character arcs.
Yeah.
Loki's very interesting in that not only does he get arcs in his movies, but he's had arcs across the MCU. A metatextual arc, if you will, that so just to briefly breeze through it.
Why don't you go into what metatext is first, because I don't know that that's an approachable term for everybody.
Hey, that's a good point. So metatext is things that are not said outside of the thing that you're enjoying. The relatable comic book version is Deadpool. Deadpool's in a comic, but then he mentions the facts that he's in a comic. That's metatextual. So it's outside of the actual comic book, but he's aware of it and mentioning that. Yeah, so metatextually, until this series, Loki hasn't known that he's had an arc.
Yeah.
So to spell out what his like metatextual arc has been, in the first Thor, he's basically a secret villain. He's very conniving. He's introduced as pitting people against people.
Yeah.
He's not full overt villain yet, right?
Yeah, he's just kind of the dick brother more than anything.
Exactly. He faces his first defeat in that one, goes to Thanos, and now we're up to the first Avengers film where he is the full stop villain. And this is also where we're meeting him at the beginning of this series. Right. So he's Shakespearean. He's kind of bold. But his whole plan against the Avengers is basically his plan from Thor. He's just still pitting people against each other.
Yep. But I mean, that can work really well, especially when you're a weak physically character. One of the best way, like as a weak person, if I have to get in a fight, the first thing I do is turn the other components against one another so I don't have to fight them all.
Right. Exactly. And so when he leaves the Avengers, he's now been defeated twice. And the next time we see him is in Thor 2, and he's fully broken. He's like presenting that he's not, and this is part of his personality more than anything, is just that he puts on airs. It's all about the illusion. He's still kind of secretly plotting, and he kind of becomes an anti-hero by the end of Thor 2. He helps out Thor, but he still like spins it so the end that he ends up being Odin, and it's got this very unique flavor to it. From there, his next step in his character arc happens in Thor Ragnarok, where he finally becomes willing to work with others and be himself and grow as this anti-hero slash hero type. He's the best example of that is the very end of the movie. Thor says, "I'd give you a hug if you were really here." And lo and behold, Loki's actually there.
Yep. For the first time, because like there's a whole trend throughout the whole series of films where like Loki's not actually there; it's just an illusion or a projection.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So that was his growth, and we see the totality of his growth in Infinity War, where in the first 10 minutes, he dies for his brother and for his people. That so his full course of character arc is to learn lessons through failure. Eventually to become the god and hero he was meant to be.
And he really was burdened by that glorious purpose to the point that he lost his life over it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which is
didn't
not something
know...
you'd expect his character to do.
Exactly. Doesn't even know the weight of the words that he was saying back in Avengers.
Yeah.
The thing that popped out to me as I was going through his arc leading up to Loki is that's a perfect dark mirror to Thor's arc across these movies. Thor keeps learning through failure until he finally becomes the hero that he's meant to be, and is left in Endgame, the last movie that I haven't mentioned yet.
Yep.
Endgame leaves us with a now living Loki, the start of this series, off to basically restart his character arc. Endgame also ends with Thor running off with the Guardians to restart his entire character arc. That may have happened somewhere in cinema in a low-key way that I've never heard of before, but I'm pretty confident in saying I've never seen that happen across cinema. And maybe it can't even happen until the MCU. I don't know. But Aaron, what do you think about just the aspects of his arc? What have been your favorite parts of his arc? Question one. And then question two, where do you see Thor falling in with your some of the observations you've made about Loki so far?
So I think one of my favorite things about his early arc is the scene in Avengers where he is talking to Black Widow. And they've established earlier on in the film that Black Widow interrogates from a submissive permission. You believe that you are interrogating her, but she is actually asking you the questions and she's gleaning the knowledge from you. And in that movie, they have that scene where they have like an extended back and forth. And at the very end, Natasha puts together, he's going to use the Hawk because she keys in on him mentioning the monster on the, what is it called? Is it Helicarrier? Is that the official name of it?
Helicarrier.
Yeah, Helicarrier. And I would argue, and I didn't really think about it until I was rewatching it prior to this series, that if you look into a lot of the things that Loki says in that interaction, it projects so much about that character.
Yeah.
Like, I think on one level, Loki's role has kind of been made bigger as the MCU has continued because he has been such an intense fan favorite. But I also wonder how much of his arc was planned because of just how insane Disney is with regards to planning. Like, it really feels like him and Thor were just very deliberately planned out to end in that kind of way. And it reminds me of Cadence almost in music, where things just resolve the way they're supposed to.
Right. It's poetry, it rhymes.
But so I think that it's really interesting thinking about that arc and understanding that we're going to go through a completely different arc. We're not going to have the Thor character to really bounce him off of. We're going to finally see him on his own and what that does, because he's not going to have any of the normal things that are usually his support structure. He's going to be able to win over Mobius in such a time, I think, but it's going to take time. For a while, it's going to be intensely lonely.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. I think the potential for what can happen now that we've seen everything that has happened, and I think another just kind of off the cuff projection, I think Thor's going to go through the same thing. Yeah. He's going to get real lonely off with a bunch of people he doesn't know.
Yeah.
And so whether it's in the next Guardians movie or in his own next movie, I think they're going to have even more disparately, proportionately different arcs. And that's really exciting, because I think Loki is the blueprint.
Yep.
I really think Loki's the blueprint for how to do that kind of thing.
And I think it's very similar to how a lot of queer people feel, where you, and this is going to foreshadowing for the next section up. A lot of queer people can relate to the experience of having like a family that for one reason or another has not been able to accept them. And they have to go out on their own. They have to go into a world where they don't really know much about it. A lot of times these are very sheltered people that may have had like a really extremely religious family. And there's a lot of parallels between that and how queer people feel. And I think that I'm really glad that they're doing it with a character that is explicitly queer, so we can, you know, we can have that reading of our own. Like, yeah, that's not the explicit reason for why he can't go back to see his family, but he is a queer character who has been separated from his family and who needs to find a family of his own, like friends and people that mean things to him outside of just blood. And I think that that's going to be an interesting point where we get to realize just how little blood means.
Yeah, definitely. Found families is such a, I think, very specifically our generation and going forward thought process. You know, you had the nuclear family from the 50s, and that's kind of skirting away. Like, finding your family and picking the people you're going to be around is super important to how you view yourself and how you feel about yourself, for sure. That realization from Loki that he can't go home comes off of watching these projections on the wall from his past. And this is the other coolest thing. I'm still geeking about this from a writing level. I mentioned this at the beginning briefly, I think. But the idea that Loki's character development for this series is based on seeing his character development from the previous movies that he hasn't lived through yet. That is super unique. That is a really tough thing to... You could, I think, express that in a single movie or a single series, but the fact that we have 20 years of... 20 years of Avengers? No, it's not 20 yet, is it? A decade of Loki.
Yeah.
Building up through across these movies with tons of screen time. He probably has a movie's worth of his own screen time at this point. And... This character, this new Loki that we're seeing, because that's really what he is, like we established, this is 2012 fresh face Loki. He gets to see everything that already happened and then start his own journey, which could easily end up in the same place that it did, getting killed by, you know, some big bad to save the world. But what if it doesn't turn out that way? What if that's the changing thing in helping him land somewhere totally different? The what I wanted to compare it to in my notes initially was there's a movie called Predestination.
Yeah.
Where it's kind of a fucky movie. A guy basically through time travel conundrums becomes his own wife and father through, you know, gender transition and then sleeping with himself and then bearing himself as a child. I'm reducing a 2-hour film down to like, you know, a minute, but that's essentially what happens. And so the point there is this character's character development is based on not knowing the things that he's going to do in the future.
Yeah.
Loki being in this like time stretched realm and messing around with time elements,
yeah,
we get to see exactly the opposite, and that he knows exactly what his past is and yeah, going forward gets to figure out what the future is with the people that set the future. So yeah, I like how kind of intentionally opposite those things are.
Yeah. To circle back to where you originally started the thought with about other things that have done it, the only thing that I can really think of are things like A Christmas Carol and films that have literally just taken A Christmas Carol and just packaged it up a little bit different.
Yep.
And
yeah,
they have always come off as kind of trite and hit you over the head.
Right.
But this felt fresh, even though I knew it was something that I had seen before in Christmas Carol. It felt fresh. Because I don't know, it there's so many things about that scene that make it interesting. Weirdly enough, I really like how they made it look like a hollow projection and everything like that. A lot of times they had like characters cropped, like the backgrounds cropped out, so you just had characters in frame. So like even though, yeah, it was things that you had seen before, it looked different.
Yeah.
One of the things that was really nice about how they did the scene where Loki gets the Tesseract and ends up in this predicament in the first place is they basically took like alternate takes from the Avengers. And
yeah,
that's why some of the line deliveries sound different. And that's why they have some different angles and stuff like that. So they could have the same event and the same general things happen with the outcome being a little bit different at the end, but have it still feel like something fresh and new.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think to your point, the reason that it feels so fresh is A Christmas Carol ends with that transformation.
Yeah.
Loki's starting there.
Yep.
That's point one. We get to see, yep, where it goes from there. So I think like if there was A Christmas Carol 2,
yeah,
where Ebenezer Scrooge is the good guy and turns back to evil or something, I would watch the fuck out of that. But
ooh,
It would have to be a totally new thing, and that's kind of the space that Loki's taking up here, is their ability to say, well, yeah, what if there was another hour at the end of A Christmas Carol?
And now on to my favorite section of this show, big queer themes. These are the themes that we are going to be tracking over the course of the show to see whether or not Loki is progressing in them, whether the show just drops them of a hole, and whether they're being handled with authenticity and with sensitivity. So why don't we start off with the first of our big gay themes, which is probably going to be a pretty prevalent theme in a lot of people's lives, which is religious oppression and how to reclaim it. Seth, do you want to start on your life with religion, the short version?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was raised extremely conservative Christian. And when I say extremely, think whatever you're thinking of, like, two
it's the,
rungs
basically
lower.
Basically the Duggars. Think the Duggars and you're about there.
Yeah. Pretty apt. Not quite the giant family aspect, but
yeah,
a lot of their other life
Wait,
aspects
how many siblings
are,
do you have again?
I have four.
Still sizable compared to like
yeah,
most
yeah,
siblings nowadays.
Very true. My parents were also into adoption, though, so that added to the family.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's, you know, religious oppression and reclaiming it. I have no, drive to reclaim it at all.
Yeah.
I really don't. I think there are parts of spirituality and, knowing myself and, you know, Eastern religion and stuff like that, that like definitely creep up within my life. But,
yeah,
needing to claim a large group with like minds that, like, functions in that way, not
yeah,
necessary. I much prefer friends that think similarly to me and discussing like communism and drug use and stuff like that. Like, that'll be my religion, but I don't need to put a name on it.
Yeah.
What about you?
I think for me, so my parents aren't very religious, but my extended family is. On one side, it's Catholic. On the other side, it's Episcopalian. A weird offshoot group of Episcopalian that is like homophobic and all that jazz, which isn't great. So while my parents never put me under any pressure, and like my best friend since I was 6 years old, when I met her, she had two moms. So like the person that I hung out with the most as a child had lesbian parents, and my parents were totally cool with it.
Mm.
But I was aware of how like people outside of our like family treated her and her family, how My extended family, my aunt used to send my mom like anti-homosexual propaganda. Like as soon as email became a thing, every single email, like, every other day, my mom was getting like just anti-gay, like all the babies are going to die if we're gay. So like I didn't have it as bad as anywhere near most people did. But then I did go to Catholic school. And that was really the first time that, like, faith and this whole idea of, like, oh you're, you know, you're demonic or you're possessed or you're evil or, like, all of those sort of villainous traits were really, like, placed upon me. And for me, like, my Twitter bio is the villain coded vindicated because a lot of times queer people do feel like they are villain coded. And villains in media are very queer-coded, Loki being a very big example of that. But he's actually queer, so makes sense.
Right.
Explicitly so. And just the whole, realizing that I'm not a villain just because other people say that or just because of who I love or just because of what my gender identity is. But kind of like pulling like a Lil Nas X and Monteroing that shit. Like, if they're going to make me out to be the demon, then fine. Okay. I don't care. It doesn't mean anything to me because I don't believe in that sort of stuff. But if that is something that I can draw strength from, if that is something that I can use to protect myself and to move forward in the world, obviously I'm not going out and like hurting other people, but the things that I learned in life from being hurt, and the things that were maladaptive that I then used to hurt others, I am learning how to use in more adaptive ways. Like I used to be really good at, you know, like telling what people's worst fears were and like what was bothering them. And I used to use that to fucking exploit them. And nowadays I'm like, hey, I noticed that there's something on your mind. Like, are you still worried about this? Or, you know, I try to use it to come from a place of empathy. So that's a big one for me. Especially the Catholicism, and that is Catholic imagery in general is really prominent in this film, or in this show.
I mean, the very first inkling of the overarching villain is set in a church in the 1500s.
I know, right? It's, you know, trying to set a point or something?
I just, you know, the throes of Christianity, setting it at that time compared to, you know, any other time is like radical almost, I think.
And I believe that's the beginning of the Protestant Reformation as well. And I honestly wonder if Loki is going to have a hand in the Protestant Reformation in some way, because I could totally see him. I could totally see that being his energy. Like, oh, let me get involved in this like religious catastrophe. And
that could be interesting.
Not
totally.
A catastrophe. Separation, I guess, would it be? It's not really a catastrophe.
Yeah, I guess it depends on whose side you were on.
Exactly. I really love, let's start talking about imagery. My favorite is the Gobi Desert when you see Loki just like falling from the sky and just the parallels to Lucifer, the morning star, falling from grace. And it's an interesting parallel because Loki has never necessarily been in grace, has he? So it's kind of like I almost kind of see it as like a reverse Lucifer mythos, potentially.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, especially in a series that's dealing with, you know, time and things, the ability for things to be reversed or be cyclical, I could almost see this series ending with a reverse shot of, you know, him going back into space and whatever future adventures he has by leaving from a desert and, you know, just the same way with that glorious purpose line, just inverting the whole thing once he's gone through the growth of what it would take to get there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. One of the other things that I really liked a lot is that there's a ton of Trinity references in this, which the Holy Trinity being enormous in Catholicism in particular, but in Christianity as a whole.
Absolutely.
You know, the three, what the hell are they called? The space people.
The timekeepers.
The timekeepers. Yeah, like the three timekeepers, which I loved the like 70s-esque animation on that. That was rad.
That reminded me of this old Mormon video that I've seen pop around YouTube. I think it's called This Is What Mormons Actually Believe, and it's presented in exactly that same format.
You know what? I think I've seen that, because I knew that it reminded me of something that I had seen before, and I couldn't quite place it. I thought it was like an animation that I had seen back then, but I think you're right.
No, there is a like religious animation studio that pumped out a bunch of stuff back in like the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
In that specific style for all different denominations. I don't even know what they're. I guess they just found their wheelhouse and got people to buy into it.
I mean, whatever works. Because it can be hard to find like an animation company that'll do something that's a little bit more. What's the word I'm looking for? I guess faith oriented.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, unless you're VeggieTales and decide to just do it yourself.
Yeah, pretty much. VeggieTales. That's a memory. And so we've mentioned the literal church, but we haven't mentioned the figurative church, the court of Ravana Renslayer, whose name isn't mentioned in the show at all, but was in the credits or on IMDb or something like that. I think that's where I pulled it out from, because I'm like, who is she supposed to be? They didn't name her at all. And they named like everybody else. So I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Love the casting. Casting was great. Her courthouse looks like a mixture. It looks like 1970s communist block meets Roman Catholic Church from the 1970s.
Very, very interesting aesthetic features where like pews, wooden pews, instead of like courthouses now have like, you know, cushioned seats or benches, and having like wooden pews laid out in that way with a middle aisle to up to the main podium. Very, very interesting kind of mix of bureaucracy and religiousness, which, I mean, you could probably argue that those two have become a little ubiquitous in
the United States
modern
definitely
times.
Yeah, I mean, back in the olden days, you used to have a church that doubled as a courthouse, so it was typical to have pews. But it's not as common, especially in newer design courthouses, to have pews. And you know, you see a lot of the Trinity imagery in there. I was trying to decide how I would describe the aesthetic of this show, and I've decided it's mid-century chronopunk. Is what I'm calling it.
Interesting.
And I just love the aesthetic that I went through. I love that the lighting is kind of like red, brown, kind of dingy. And it almost reminds me of a bar in a way too.
Yeah. The aesthetic of this reminded me so much of like the Brady Bunch and those shows that just had like shag carpet and like semi smoky looking rooms because everyone smoked indoors back then. It's kind of got that like light smog to the whole thing. Like back when people could smoke in their offices and, It had that whole feel to me.
Yeah, for sure. I can definitely see that. I think one of the other things that I really liked about it is how it kind of has that like Fallout vibe where things are simultaneously really old looking, but also like higher tech than in the current world. And I love Fallout's aesthetic. So anything that pulls out like everything that this took inspiration from, like Twin Peaks, David Fincher, like, like everything is stuff that interests me, and I'm already so like all in on this show that I just
I think this will probably come up in future episodes, but it feels like there's a strong Douglas Adams inspiration in the writing, in that like it's procedural and just kind of like matter of fact British speaking, but then a bunch of absurdism dropped in on top of it, and I love, absolutely love that kind of stuff. It keeps you on your toes at all points.
And he
was, you know, also a big writer in the 70s. So I think they really just did look into that retro futurism to inspire everything.
Yeah. Another thing that I wanted to hit in this section is there's a really good line of dialogue between Mobius and Loki there's this really interesting line that Loki says that I really resounded with, and that is, the first and most impressive lie is the song of freedom. Choice brings shame, uncertainty, and regret. And I liked that because a lot of people say, if you make this choice, if you choose to be gay, because they believe it's a choice, that you're going to experience these things, or they believe that you're going to experience those things. And I liked that those things were brought in there as well, because a lot of times it is faith that causes those feelings. There's not that many people that are just very anti-gay people and believe that it's like a horrible thing, and who are not religiously motivated, who just object to it for objection's sake.
Or maybe people that don't recognize that within themselves.
Yeah, for real. That's real.
It tends to be that homophobia and self-reflection, or lack thereof, are not normally too far apart from each other.
Funny story. As this is a queer show and Loki focuses on time travel, each week we will be featuring a different iconic queer figure in history. Credit for this segment has to go to Sebastian Crane, who has a Patreon where he does similar content where he focuses on various queer history issues. Today's iconic figure was Eleno de Cespedes, who is alive during the year 1549, which was featured during the church scene in Loki. Trigger warning: transphobia, gender dysphoria, and slavery. Today's iconic figure in queer history is Eleno de Cespedes, who was alive in the year 1549, which was featured in the church scene with Mobius and the Child. Just a heads up. As this story is from the mid-1500s, there is conflicting information from various sources on whether Cespedes was intersex, lesbian, or transgender. However, while alive, Eleno said that after marrying Maria, he viewed himself as male, so we will be using male name and pronouns accordingly. Eleno de Cespedes was born in Granada in 1546. As a biracial slave, he wasn't given a name at birth, but instead had his face branded on either side. He was allowed to stay with his mother, an African Muslim named Francisca de Medina, but regrettably, no records of his early childhood remain. However, when he was 15 or 16, one of their owners died, releasing Eleno from slavery. He was then given the name of his dead slave owner's wife. He and his mother moved in together, and he took up sewing as a trade to make money. He was forced into a contract marriage with a stonemason and fell pregnant soon after. His husband then abandoned him and is believed to have died before Eleno gave birth. His pregnancy and strenuous labor had either revealed or altered his genitals, depending on which historical account you read, and based on this, he began to transition towards existing publicly as a man. He was described by others as being hardworking, impulsive, and impetuous, with an interest in careers that were typically barred to women. Finding himself ill-suited to parenthood, he left his son in the care of another family. He took on the name Cespedes and began to pursue trade work, including weaving, hosiery, and tailoring. His luck would take a turn for the worse, however, when he went to jail for stabbing a man in self-defense. Upon release, he started wearing men's clothing and using the name Eleno. Between 1568 and 1571, war shook Granada after King Philip decided to restrict cultural and religious freedoms in the region. This caused many African Muslims to join forces against him. Wanting to pursue further traditionally male pursuits, Eleno became a soldier. He was known among his fellows as being neither man nor woman, and actively took place in several combats. After leaving the military, he moved to Madrid and began to live and work with a surgeon he'd impressed. The surgeon took Eleno on as an apprentice, teaching him surgery and anatomy, and allowed him to borrow his medical books. Realizing this was a way more financially viable career path than anything he tried so far, Eleno decided to study surgery. He won his surgeon's license in 1577 and began traveling around, practicing all of the traditional responsibilities of a surgeon. He would do this for over 10 years before falling ill himself. He found himself at the home of Francisco del Cano and would fall in love with his daughter Maria. The two would approach her father for permission to marry, and he said, "If it is God's will, so be it." However, per the custom of the time, all marriages needed to be approved by the general vicar of the province. At the time, clandestine marriages were rather common, and they believed this would help prevent bigamy. While Eleno and Maria applied for approval, Eleno's lack of facial hair, delicate structure, and high voice made others doubt he was male. After being inspected by several people, they were unable to prove he wasn't male, and he was allowed to marry. However, it would not be that easy for him and Maria. 1 year later, interfering neighbors would report him to the authorities. He was charged with sodomy, misappropriation of male clothing, heresy, and marriage profanation by not respecting its purpose and natural law, which is procreation. The case was taken by the most strict tribunal within the Spanish Inquisition, and he was sent into isolation because the inquisitors didn't want to put him with either male or female prisoners. It was a long trial and full of complications. Eleno's defense was that he was intersex, and as such could choose whether to live as man or woman in God's service. His genitals would be described in vastly different ways, sometimes by the same person who later thought differently upon second examination. He would also say that he was injured in a horse ride, causing damage that had altered his anatomy after his wedding. The Inquisitors would make wild claims, accusing Céspedes of entering into a pact with the devil to alter his genitals. He suffered unimaginable pain, being in prison isolation and defending his marriage and identity through a number of humiliating torments. The devil pact charge was obviously ludicrous, and they next pursued charges of bigamy. In his first marriage, he viewed himself as female and married a man. When his gender changed in his mind, he had started living as a man, dating women, and eventually married one. And the Inquisition accepted this, deciding that he hadn't violated any societal norms. When living as a woman, he had followed societal expectations for women, and when living as a man, he had altered his lifestyle to fit those expectations. In the end, he was found guilty of bigamy. He received 200 lashes, had his marriage annulled, and was forced to wear women's clothing while working as a surgeon without wages for 10 years. Everything he had worked so hard for, and by all accounts excelled at, was taken from him. He was originally intended to work in the Hospital del Rey, but after his trial had become quite well known, patients began traveling far distances to see him, as they believed he had supernatural healing abilities. As a result, hospital administration transferred Elena to a remote facility, describing the interest in him as an annoyance and an embarrassment. Sadly, he would ultimately die in obscurity, but due to the circumstances of his life and the success he had as a surgeon, he's remembered even today as an iconic figure in queer history. As a reminder, we are just amateur historians. I encourage you to take a look at the references in the pinned comment for further research.
Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode. We are so excited to continue this series. If you'd like to help us support doing that, we have a Patreon on screen right now, patreon.com/Montressor Media. Access is $1. You can see the extended versions of episodes of this show, plus all of the podcasts that we run. They should be showing up below me on the screen here. If I'm a liar, you can just type liar in the comments. I'd like to invite you again to please like, subscribe, and leave us a comment below, even if you just enjoyed yourself. We would very much like to hear from you. Again, this is an open conversation. These episodes are to get the conversation going. That conversation continues on our Patreon and our Discord. That's Montressor Media on Discord.
And if you want to follow Seth and myself, which we highly recommend because both of us post a lot on social media, those links will be down below and in the description.
Well, I guess the only question we didn't answer on this episode was, does Loki suck dick, Aaron?
That's actually a really interesting question, Seth, and I'm glad that you asked me, because if you...